Sex trafficking has been moving from the streets to the web. So, cops have to move online too.
The average age of entry into this lifestyle is 13 to 14 years old. That's not a victimless crime at all.
I'm Mark Brody. Also today on the show, a founder of Phoenix-based Freeport MacMoran steps down. The Arizona Corporation Commission has a new interim chair, helping undocumented teens adjust to life in the U.S., and a new coach could have a big payoff.
Now, I know it's swimming and not football or men's basketball, so people are going to look at it differently. But just the caliber of person that they've hired here is probably the greatest coaching hire that's ever been made at ASU.
Plus, taking a hike nearly 800 years back and young photographers using old technology. That and more on the show after a check of this hour's news. Good afternoon. It's the show on KJZZ with Steve Goldstein. I'm Mark Brody. Checking Valley traffic, I-17 northbound, a crash at Thunderbird has the center lanes blocked. I-17 northbound, the crash on Bell is no longer blocking the on-ramp there. We're looking for sunny skies for the rest of the afternoon, looking for a high of 57 degrees, still well below average. 65 is average for today. Clear and cold tonight, overnight lows in the mid-30s. Sunny skies tomorrow with a high of 60. It's 50 degrees right now at KJZZ. The attorney for an Arizona prison teacher who was raped by an inmate in 2014 says a settlement has been reached in her lawsuit against the state. KJZZ's Matthew Casey has more.
The lawsuit accused Arizona Department of Corrections officials of not protecting the teacher when they left her alone with inmates while she gave a GED exam at a state prison in Florence. Terms of the December 22nd settlement were not disclosed. The woman's attorney, Scott Zwillinger, would only say the settlement is satisfactory to his client. A spokeswoman for Arizona Attorney General Mark Brnovich says a court order prohibits talking about the settlement. Court records say Jacob Harvey was in prison for raping a Phoenix woman when he repeatedly stabbed the teacher with a pen before sexually assaulting her. He pleaded guilty and is now serving life in prison. Matthew Casey, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
The Arizona Corporation Commission has a new interim chair after this morning's meeting. KJZZ's Will Stone has been covering the Corporation Commission and the various dealings with it and joins me. So, Will, who is the new interim chair?
The new interim chair is Commissioner Doug Little. The commission was set to elect a permanent chair today. This is because earlier this month, the chair of the commission, Susan Bittersmith, announced she would resign effective next week. And that was after the attorney general had called on the state Supreme Court to remove her from office because of conflict of interest issues. What the commission decided today was unanimously elect Commissioner Doug Little as the acting chair and then take another vote when Bittersmith's replacement comes into office. However, it was indicated by several commissioners at the meeting that Doug Little would most likely be the choice for a permanent chair when that vote finally happens. Little is in his first term on the commission. He's a Republican. He was elected last year, and he spent about three decades in the software industry before being elected.
Susan Bittersmith, as you say, will be stepping down not just as chair of the commission, but also from the commission itself. The governor will be appointing a replacement. The commission itself, though, also has a new staffer who it seems like will be looking into some of the ethical issues that have been dogging some of the members of the commission over the past little while.
Yes, we learned just this week that the commission has created a new executive-level position. One of the titles is ethics officer. It's also special counsel. And this person will be dealing with open meeting law, conflict of interest, and the ever-growing pile of public records requests for the commission. They've chosen to hire Christopher Kempley. He's a former advisor for the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission. He was also the chief counsel for the Arizona Corporation Commission prior to that. And as we discussed earlier, the hire is significant because the commission has had its share of controversy and been under increasing public scrutiny in recent months. Obviously, the chairman recently just decided to resign because of conflict of interest issues. And additionally, Commissioner Bob Stump is engaged in this high-profile fight with a Washington-based watchdog group, which is funded by clean energy interests, about text messages that are allegedly connected to those dark money contributions and whether or not he was coordinating that with now Commissioners Tom Friess and Doug Little prior to the primary elections.
Lots more to keep an eye on. KJZZ's Will Stone will be doing that. Will, thank you.
Thanks, Mark.
One of the co-founders of Phoenix-based Freeport-McMoRan is resigning from his position as executive chairman. James Moffitt will become chairman emeritus and will stay on as a consultant to the board. For more on what this means for the company now and in the future, I'm joined by Chuck Bradford. He's president of Bradford Research and has been analyzing the mining and metals industry for more than 50 years.
I've known Jim Bob for many years.
That's what Mr. Moffitt goes by.
Yes. I've got a great deal of respect for him, but you need to keep in mind that he started out as a geologist specializing in oil and gas. And that was really some of the roots of Freeport-McMoRan. The company had a major discovery in Indonesia of a copper gold mine, maybe the best mine ever found. Certainly one of the largest, highest grade, lowest cost. And he led to the development of this mine for many years.
Does it say anything about sort of the state of the industry overall that this move is happening now?
I think it's much more Jim Bob's age. I mean, the man's 77 years old. I've thought for some time that it didn't quite sound as vibrant as he had in the past. But as far as I know, for a 77-year-old man, he was doing pretty well.
So you think it had less to do with the fact that some of the prices of metals like copper have been going down recently and share prices have been going down than this individual sort of stage of life?
Well, of the companies that I cover, I mean, Freeport shares clearly are down a lot, but they're not by any means the worst. And there isn't anything a mining company can really do about metal prices. I mean, they do try to reduce output at the margin when prices fall, but there's also one key factor in the mining business that people forget, and that's that mines deplete.
So given a company's sort of lack of control over some of the factors that control its business and its share price, do you expect significant changes with the new leadership at Freeport-McMoRan now that Mr. Moffitt is stepping down?
Well, Richard Acheson is still CEO, and the CEO is the guy that really runs the company. I mean, Jim Bob Moffitt, as I understand in the last few years, has been more of an executive chairman. So he's involved with the decision-making, but day-to-day operation, you know, he has some goal-setting, if you will, and clearly major input. And just what happened yesterday in the stock market, I'm pretty much to tell people that Jim Bob is highly respected. The stock was down almost 10% on the announcement that he was retiring.
I wanted to ask you sort of about his importance to the company. He's also somebody who started this company all those years ago. Does it do anything to sort of the company's image or its employees to see somebody who started this thing sort of moving his way out now?
Well, frankly, I've been expecting that he would retire over the last couple of years. In any case, a great deal of the companies that I cover have 65 as a mandatory retirement age. Some even move people off the board of directors by 75. So that should not be unexpected.
Chuck Bradford is president of Bradford Research and has been analyzing the metals and mining industry for more than five decades. We were talking about Freeport-McMoRan's executive chairman, James Moffitt, stepping down.
A couple of summers ago, a number of Southwest communities, including the Valley, were impacted by an influx of undocumented immigrant children from Central America. Those kids ended up in immigration and customs enforcement facilities. Many had tried to escape gang wars and poverty in their home countries, but then found themselves with restrictions in the U.S. and without knowledge of basic things, such as the English language. Sherry Jones is the director of the Phoenix Dream Center Living Youth Program. The Dream Center recently began accepting undocumented teens. Sherry, how much did you pay attention to the initial stories about the undocumented kids who'd come in from Central America?
You know, actually, I'm an educator by profession, so when I saw those youth on the news, it pricked my heart. You know, I began to go, who's serving these kids? And then it was kind of one of those things of, wait a minute, we're doing that here at the Dream Center. Our motto has always been find a need and fill it, find a hurt and heal it. So I began to check around. I said, I don't know anything about these youth. I don't know where they come from, where they're going to. I went to our executive director, Pastor Brian Steele, and said, there's some kids out there that need help. So let's figure out a way to help them. And he encouraged me to do that. About 2 or 3 days later, I received a call from the Florence Project, which is a volunteer group of immigration lawyers who are trying to help these young people get their visas, their passports, their green cards, all those kinds of things. So it all fit together to bring them in.
I wonder if you could sort of compare and contrast those a little bit. When you have American kids, let's say from Phoenix, who end up at the Dream Center, as opposed to the refugees, are you seeing a different type of feeling, a different type of flavor, a different type of adjustment they have to make?
To a certain extent, we are, yeah. They are all young adults. They are all 18 years old, and at 18, you pretty much think that you can conquer the world. But our refugee kiddos do come in with a great deal of fear. They come from mostly Central American countries, El Salvador, Guatemala, Honduras, some from Mexico. We even have one young lady that is from Africa. And they come in with a great deal of fear. They don't speak the language, or if they do, not very well. They haven't been here long enough. They don't know a big city. They don't know the transportation system. They don't have any finances. They don't have any insurance. They don't have very many clothing. They really don't have what they need. And there's a great deal of fear when we first get them. Our aged out foster youth have been in a little more stable situation, being in group homes, being in foster care. Although they may have been tossed around through, 20 or 30 different group homes, they have had some stability here. They can speak English. They know their way around on the city bus system.
You mentioned when you heard about the undocumented kids how it pricked your heart. And now that you know some of these kids, how has that affected your heart?
They're precious. They are really precious kids. You know, they're here hoping for the American dream. Their parents sent them here thinking that that'd be a whole lot better than keeping them in a country that is controlled by drug cartels and crime and violence. So, you know, they've been sent here to sort of pursue that American dream and maybe be able to help their families back home in some of those very, very poor countries. So once you get to know them and you realize that their heart is just like any other young person's heart, they want to be successful. They want to make some money. Mm-hmm. They want to have all the things in life that everybody else wants, and you get close to them.
How many undocumented kids do you have there now? And is there a goal? Can you grow and have many more?
We can grow and have more. Right now, we only have two as of today. We have had eight in the last about 2.5 months since we started the program. So some of them come in overnight. Maybe they have a plane ticket to an uncle somewhere that's going to take them. Or perhaps it's going to take a couple of weeks or a month or 2 months to get their papers ready, their legal papers ready, and to go to court and to do all of that, which is very frightening for them in itself. We have a young man with us now who will be with us probably 6 months before his entire paperwork is ready due to some other issues in his life.
Sherry Jones, director of the Phoenix Dream Center's Living Youth Program.
ASU swimming is getting a new coach, Michael Phelps. Yep, that Michael Phelps will be joining his and the school's new coach in a volunteer capacity. Jeff Metcalf is a reporter for the Arizona Republic and AZ Central Sports. He covers the Olympics and has been writing about the Olympics' most decorated athlete coming to the Valley.
When Arizona State hired Bob Bowman as its head swim coach, Bob, of course, has coached Michael his entire career. And it was pretty obvious at the time that Michael wasn't going to try to go into his last Olympics without staying with Bob. So they discussed the situation. This was in April, just this past April. They discussed the situation, and Michael said, I've got someone on the staff at North Baltimore Aquatics I'd like to come along. And Bob said, no problem. We want him to come too and work with ASU, kind of a trainer guy named Keenan Robinson. So when they were able to work that out, then, Michael was all on board with making the move out here. Now this year he's not allowed to work with ASU athletes in any way because he's a pro athlete training for the Olympics. But after he retires, after this next Olympics, assuming he qualifies for the Olympics, then he has told Bob that he'd like to be a volunteer coach. And certainly, you know, that's something that sort of indicates, I think, his rekindled love for the sport, that he would want to do it in the first place.
Does having Bob Bowman and eventually Michael Phelps lift ASU swimming to another level?
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, it has to. You know, you basically have a Hall of Fame coach. It might be the greatest coaching hire. In my mind, it's probably the greatest coaching hire in ASU history in any sport. Now, I know it's swimming and not football or men's basketball, so people are going to look at it differently. But just the caliber of person that they've hired here is probably the greatest coaching hire that's ever been made at ASU. And then, of course, Phelps, just, you know, about to qualify for his fifth Olympics, the greatest Olympian of all time, more medals, more gold medals. I mean, who wouldn't want to come and be part of that environment?
Have there been any discussions about what exactly Michael Phelps will be doing as a coach and what maybe his specialty or a particular thing that he'll be working on?
You know, I didn't really get into that with him too much, but he did reiterate several times that he's really looking to have an opportunity to kind of be hands-on and talk to people and use his knowledge that he's gained over the years, you know, kind of a payback type of thing for the sport. So I would guess that, you know, the events that are his specialties, you know, the IM, the some of the longer freestyle events or middle distance freestyle events, I'm certainly that'll kind of be his, where he'll start with his expertise. But, you know, how it's going to play out exactly, I'm not really sure. All the coaches on the staff are working with him, on Bob's staff are working with the men and the women, so I'm guessing he'll probably be working with both of them. I guess we'll just have to see how it kind of plays out.
There's an old adage in sports that oftentimes the best performers on the field don't necessarily make the best coaches or managers. Is there any concern that Michael Phelps is so talented and so much of this comes so naturally to him that he might not be able to actually impart his knowledge and help student athletes who maybe don't have the same amount of talent as he does?
You know, maybe to a certain level you could make that argument, but I'm not sensing that at all. In fact, Bowman told me that he thinks Michael is just, he's got more knowledge to impart and thinks and cares about the sport and has studied the sport more than people really realize. So I just think if he was coming in like a full-time coach or something where he was going to have maybe some real kind of grinded out responsibilities more than he may have in a volunteer role, that might be different. But I'm not so sure that, you know, I think this is the right way to just sort of dip your toe in the water, so to speak, and then just find out, you know, do I really want to go further with it, or am I just happy kind of doing it on this end? And he's going to have a new child by this point, so he's going to have a lot going on in his life that will kind of carry him into the next phase, and I think this is a good way to start. But he's a very good communicator, and it's hard for me to believe that he's not going to be able to get across his points to college students.
Jeff Metcalf is a reporter and covers the Olympics for the Arizona Republic and AZ Central Sports. Jeff, thank you.
Yeah, thanks a lot. I really appreciate it.
Coming up, we'll take an Arizona hike and travel back in time, but, you know, watch out for the quicksand.
If you've ever opened a jar of natural peanut butter, the kind that hasn't been stirred up, it's sort of mucky, and your foot hits it, and it just starts to sink down. It sucks in, and the sand closes around your heel or your foot.
Hiking Keat Seal, that's ahead. It's the show. Good Tuesday afternoon. Thanks for joining us on the show here on KJZZ. I'm Mark Brody along with Steve Goldstein. Checking Valley traffic, I-17 northbound at Thunderbird. A crash has the shoulder block there. Also on the 17 northbound, a crash on the Greenway Road on-ramp. And in the West Valley, I-10 eastbound, a crash blocks the shoulder at Watson Road. Look for sunny skies for the rest of the afternoon across the valley, looking for a high of 57 degrees. We hit 59 yesterday, 65 is average. Clear tonight, overnight lows in the mid-30s. Then sunny skies tomorrow right on through New Year's Day with highs right around 60. Tomorrow warming up a bit to the mid-60s by the end of the week. Right now in Phoenix, sunny skies, 53 degrees at KJZZ at 223.
KJZZ is supported by Cancer Treatment Centers of America. In Phoenix, launching 12 additional clinical trials to provide new treatment options for cancer, including prostate, lung, and colorectal. CancerCenter.com, keywords clinical trials.
It's the show for Tuesday, December 29th. Along with the takeaways, Todd Zwillick, I'm Mark Brody. There's a broad debate going on about communications on the internet. Who controls the shape and the space of cyberspace itself? The internet of today and of the future is not the boundless, unregulated sea of free ideas and speech that we once envisioned. Instead, it's largely become a marketplace where the rules and the borders are shaped by corporations who operate in their own interest. Here's Scott Malcolmson, author of SplinterNet, How Geopolitics and Commerce Are Fragmenting the World Wide Web.
I think it's shaped more like Google and Apple and not so much like the U.S. Constitution.
Apple and Google and other companies, too, deciding the shape of the internet. And at the same time, governments who want to control or watch the flow of information. Here's Scott Malcolmson again.
What happens next is political rather than technical. What happens next is that people organize in order to try and defend or take back a right of expression over the internet.
So-called digital dissenters are part of what Scott Malcolmson is talking about there, a growing group of activists and thinkers who want users to take back control of cyberspace from corporations, from marketers, and from surveillance. One of those digital dissenters joins me now. Astra Taylor is a documentary filmmaker and author of The People's Platform, Taking Back Power and Culture in the Digital Age. Astra Taylor, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Well, you and your cohorts, I guess, have been called dissenters or humanists or team human, even Luddites by some people. Describe this movement and its main objections to the shape of today's internet.
Yeah, I think even if you go back 5 or 6 years, a lot of the discussions about the internet were very triumphalist. Social media was going to bring down the old media model and usher in a democratized media era where the sort of everyday person could triumph over established interests. And it's interesting because in the last few years, the conversation's gotten a bit more doubtful, right? There have been revelations from Snowden about government surveillance, and there have been revelations about labor abuses from companies like Apple, or even the discussion that's going on about the way platforms like Uber treat their workers. I think what the cohort I'm part of, or at least the purpose of my book, The People's Platform, was really to say it actually, we don't have to get mired in disappointment. You know, there could be another way. And the internet isn't a people's platform. It's corporatized all the way down. In fact, there's no such thing as a public internet, but it could be. So in that sense, I'm definitely not anti-technological. And the Luddites are mistaken as being anti-tech, right? They were these textile workers who broke the looms in the early 19th century. And so you can kind of see them as these people who were, you know, on Team Flintstone as opposed to Team Jetson or something. They hated the future. They hated technology. But actually, they were protesting their exploitation and the fact that, you know, machines were being used to drive down their wages and make their lives more difficult. So I think in that sense, perhaps I am a Luddite, if you look at it not as being anti-tech, but really being anti-inequality and anti-exploitation.
So then taking back the internet and the free expression and the free movement and non-corporatization that you think it was meant to be, or at least envisioned to be when it was first strung together, when those computers were strung together, how does that happen? What do you envision people doing to get out from under Apple and Google and Snapchat and Facebook?
Yeah, people have to organize. And this is the thing. One thing I try to emphasize is that, you know, we've sort of been here before. When we talk about the internet, it's like change and revolution and disruption. And we really emphasize the novelty. You know, how amazing is it that we can leave comments for our friends when we used to only have a few channels or a few hundred channels to choose from? Or, you know, back in the day when it was only the radio or the television to entertain you. A lot of the problems of the old media model have carried over. And I'm thinking about centralization, consolidation, and commercialism mainly. You know, the fact that, yeah, sure, we have these personalized devices, but they're all connected to a sort of very centralized, opaque back end that few of us understand. The fact that there's been a return of monopolies and also vertical integration. So you can see a company like Amazon that doesn't just sell books, but it's the bookstore and it offers web hosting services, right? And commercialism, the fact that we have this remarkable new technology and it is funded through this retrograde model of advertising. It's like we've gone back to the past, to the old days of, our news being sponsored by Camel cigarettes and stuff. We all see the return of branded content and advertising dollars fund this whole thing, just like didn't, you know, the television era.
And I wanted to ask you about that, mm-hmm. because people complain, of course, about when you use Facebook because it's free, that means you're the product, your information, your likes and dislikes. None of that is new. We've None seen this before. We've been the product on television for decades. Free ads targeted to the audience the content is designed to attract.
Exactly. So in a sense, I'm saying the disruption didn't go deep enough. You know, I want more disruption. I want us to disrupt those underlying business models, because that's the problem, the economic system our technologies are embedded in, not the technology itself. And the fact that the old business models have essentially carried over, and in fact, they've metastasized, right? So now advertising is even more of the funding source for more of the things we're doing, you know, not just for the television shows, but for our basic communications. So my point is that with the, you know, what to do is to look back to the past, to some of the old solutions that people embraced, which was to push back on advertisers, to use, you know, antitrust to break up monopolies, to institute baseline privacy laws, to open up spaces of non-commercial media. So I think the toolkit for today is actually the toolkit we used in the past. We just need to update it for a digital age.
What about individuals? Let's get practical for 1 second. Things like in private browsing, disabling cookies, the types of things that advertisers and corporations use to track your likes and dislikes so that they know how to advertise to you. Is it worth disabling those things?
I think it is worth disabling those things, though there is a paradox, because right now, if we don't pay for things directly, then, you know, the problem is that we've handed over the funding of culture online to advertisers. So, we in a way have to either pay with our personal data or we have to pay with money if we want to see certain things exist in the world. So I think, you know, there is the power of the purse for people. You know, I, for example, pay for my internet service. I don't use Gmail because I don't want to be ultimately paying with my information and having my emails be used to target ads to me. I guess I'm a bit wary of privacy being something that only the well-off can afford, privacy becoming a kind of luxury good. And I'm slightly wary of the idea that we can chop our way into a better world. That's why I really do think we actually need to band together as citizens and demand some structural changes, like baseline privacy law that would affect everybody instead of those of us who have the wherewithal, you know, protecting ourselves one by one online.
Pushing back against a corporate-based, advertising-based, tracking-based internet. Astra Taylor is a documentary filmmaker and author of The People's Platform, Taking Back Power and Culture in the Digital Age. Astra Taylor, thank you for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
That's The Takeaways, Todd Zwillick. Commercial sex trafficking is a problem worldwide and here in the Valley, but the issue has only become a law enforcement priority in recent decades, and it's just beginning to emerge as an area of responsibility for local police departments. It wasn't until 2013 that the FBI incorporated human trafficking as an offense in the Uniform Crime Reporting System. Now, a recent study by ASU, Center for Violence Prevention and Community Solutions, looks at how pervasive the problem is and how local police agencies are dealing with it. It found the vast majority of departments reported online sex advertising is up, but street prostitution is down as prostitution moves to the internet. Sergeant Kathy Click with the Tempe Police Department Special Victims Unit has been fighting sex trafficking in the Valley. The show's Lauren Gilger talked to her about that experience.
What are your perceptions of sex trafficking in the Valley? Is it increasing? Is it getting harder to fight?
I think that from a law enforcement perspective, we always thought of it like prostitution and it's, you know, a victimless crime. And then more recently, the education and the training that law enforcement officers are getting is that the average age of entry into this lifestyle is 13 to 14 years old. That's not a victimless crime at all. And honestly, I don't know if it's getting worse or if it's getting better. I know just because where I focus now, I feel like it's a lot worse because I see it more.
Can you tell me, how does it happen? How do they get drawn into this?
When you look at teenagers, like a teenage girl, somebody giving them a little extra attention, you're very susceptible to positive things in your life. So if somebody is telling you that you're funny or that you're smart or that you're good looking or that you're good at something, and they're charismatic when they do that, it's really easy to fall into that trap, because it's not like they walk up, hey, you know, you're going to work for me now. You're going to sell yourself for money at this point. That's not how it happens. They reel them in a little somehow, and then they start meeting those basic needs that aren't being met in other areas, whether that's shelter, food, clothing, or if it's just that emotional needs that are being filled. But that's how they get drawn in.
The study found that this industry is really shifting from the streets to online right now. How do you combat that as a department?
We have to stay current. And I mean, every day there's a new app. You know, there was MySpace and then Facebook and then Instagram, and now there's Snapchat and Kick, and every day there's something new, and we have to be on top of that and know the ins and outs of those, so we're able, basically, so we're able to be in the mix with it all, because if once we fall behind, it's really hard to catch up.
Does the technology make it more difficult as a law enforcement agency to fight this?
I think that it does. In elementary school, kids are on computers and they're very savvy and they know how to do things that, for some of us that haven't been using computers for our whole lives, are a little bit more challenging. You can hide things too. I mean, different apps will hide photographs or text messages or things like that. So I think the big thing for law enforcement is not to be afraid to jump in and figure it out. Because some things work and some things don't, but we're not going to know that until we get in there and try it.
So this study also found that most departments of the 72 biggest in the country is who they surveyed. Most of those departments said that their biggest challenge was actually resources, was staffing in order to fight sex trafficking. Is that your experience, or can you understand why that would be?
Resources within the police department, absolutely. Here, like in Tempe, we don't have a vice unit. And so my squad will focus on the victim interviews and getting a case ready for prosecution. And that's just because, you know, the size of our city and the size of our agency, we don't have enough people for a full-time vice unit. But I think that, you know, like when the Super Bowl was here, we were all working together. All of the agencies were working together. And so the agencies with a little bit more in that area were able to help out some that didn't have so many people focusing on that specific topic.
Right. Is interdepartment coordination like that an important way to gather those resources?
Absolutely. And you look at, you know, Phoenix, Tempe, Mesa, it's just one street that separates us. And so it doesn't really matter to me what side of 48th Street a victim is on. I want to be able to provide them with whatever they need. And my experiences with all of our Valley agencies, it doesn't matter where we find these victims, everybody is more than willing to help out because they cross the street sometimes, and we have to help each other out.
Tempe Police Sergeant Kathy Click. She's with the Special Victims Unit, the unit that fights sex trafficking on the street and now online, as a recent ASU study found a big uptick in the amount of online sex trafficking advertising. For the show, I'm Lauren Gilger.
Still to come, with one game left to go before the playoffs, could this be the year for the Cardinals?
You have to look at the way the Cardinals are playing right now, the consistency with which they played all season, and say they're there. They're among the top teams in the NFL.
The keys to the Cards' success, that's ahead. It's the show. Good afternoon. It's the show on KJZZ. Along with Steve Goldstein, I am Mark Brody in Phoenix. Quickly checking Valley traffic, I-17 northbound. A crash has the shoulder blocked at Thunderbird. Looks like there's a bit of a delay behind that one, though, so watch out for it. Also an accident I-10 eastbound at Watson Road. It'll be sunny for the rest of the day. Today, look for a high of 57 degrees, a couple degrees cooler than yesterday. Still well lower than average, cooler than average here in the Valley. 65 degrees, the average high for today. Clear skies on the way for tonight. Overnight lows in the mid-30s. Then it'll be sunny right through New Year's Day with a high tomorrow of 60 degrees. It's 53 at KJZZ at 237.
KJZZ is supported by Ring by Name, a cloud-based phone service for small businesses working to help you build better relationships with your customers and designed to make your business run better. You can learn more at ringbyname.com.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Windsor Johnston. Cleveland is preparing for protests after a grand jury decided not to bring charges in the fatal police shooting of Tamir Rice. Mayor Frank Jackson says although the criminal part of the case is over, there's still work to be done.
We're tasked with administrative review of what happened that day and to determine if there's any disciplinary actions we will take in regards to the officers involved.
The 12-year-old was shot by police while playing with an air gun in a public park. The Chicago police officer who shot and killed a 17-year-old is pleading not guilty to murder charges. Sean Kennedy of member station WBEZ reports the officer has concerns over getting a fair trial.
Officer Jason Van Dyke was charged with murder hours before the release of a video that showed him shooting Laquan McDonald 16 times. That touched off weeks of demonstrations that continue to this day. Van Dyke's attorney, Daniel Herbert, says they haven't decided yet whether to try to get the case moved out of Chicago.
If we make the decision that a change of venue is something needed in order for my client to get a fair trial, then we'll absolutely explore that option.
Van Dyke is charged with 6 counts of first-degree murder and 1 count of official misconduct. For NPR News, I'm Sean Kennedy in Chicago.
Severe flooding in the Midwest is blamed for a number of fatalities. In Missouri today, Governor Jay Nixon toured Perry County, where a record crest is expected along the Mississippi River.
I'll commit to you that we will be here with you in this fight. We'll provide the assets that are necessary. And when the water starts going down, we'll be the first people here to make sure that the economic loss is as small as it can possibly be.
The Coast Guard has closed a section of the Mississippi River near St. Louis due to the flooding. Stocks traded higher today on Wall Street at the close. The Dow was up 192 points at 17,720. The Nasdaq up 66 points. The S&P 500 up 21. This is NPR News in Washington.
You may have visited ruins in different parts of Arizona, but one in northern Arizona called Keat Seal stands out more than others. It has been incomparably well preserved. And when Keat Seal is open to hikers and backpackers, only 20 permits a day are issued. Arizona Highways Editor-in-Chief Robert Steve experienced Keat Seal and wrote about it for the magazine's January issue. Robert, why only 20 permits, and why on the day you went were only 2 of those permits being used?
These are very delicate places, all of these ruins, and some have been restored, some have not. Keat Seal is in a very remote canyon on the Navajo Nation. It's actually part of the National Park Service. There are 3 ruins in a place called Navajo National Monument. The ruins are actually on federal land. They're national monument land. But to get to each of these sites, you have to cross the Navajo Nation. And so what the Park Service does, which manages the flow of traffic into these places, by the way, to get back to Keat Seal, it's about a 17 or 18 mile round trip hike to get back there. So to sort of keep the traffic at a minimum, the Park Service only issues 20 permits per day. In addition, you're only allowed to actually hike back to the ruins in what I would describe the hottest part of the season and the most unpleasant part of the year, which is June, July, and August, where you're dealing with obviously warmer temperatures, but also monsoon season. So you can get flash flooding and things back there. So, and you don't want, you know, masses like you see on the south rim of the Grand Canyon, you know, converging on a place like this. They require anyone who goes back in there to do an orientation to really impress upon you just how fragile this environment is. This place was occupied in the late 1200s, and much of it is exactly as it was then. So it's delicate, and they want to impress that upon all visitors. But also, getting back to the ruins requires, you know, you go through quicksand, literally. You can deal with flash floods, rattlesnakes, West Nile virus. There's a lot of natural, you know, impediments to getting back there. So they really want to have the hiker and backpacker have a good understanding of what they're getting into.
Yeah, I didn't expect to read quicksand in your piece, but you mentioned how you had to train yourself for it, and then you had what you described as like a 5-second experience with it. Can you tell us how that felt?
You know, I grew up watching Gilligan's Island, so my vision of quicksand wasn't quite what they have out there, but it is actually quicksand, and, you know, you're anticipating it because what it is, you're crossing this creek so many times, and there's sand, and it's the way I guess I would best describe it is if you've ever opened a jar of natural peanut butter, the kind that hasn't been stirred up or needs to be stirred up, it's sort of mucky, and your foot hits it, and it just starts to sink down. It sucks in, and the sand closes around your heel or your foot, and you know, because I was prepared for it, because of the orientation, you sort of rock back and forth on your heels, and you pop out. So it did exactly as it was supposed to. But yeah, I was a little alarmed at first, and that happened early on, and I kind of thought to myself, oh boy, do I have 18 more miles of this up ahead of me? But that was actually the only experience I had with it. Plus, you get to recognize what those spots look like. You get, you know, adept pretty quickly.
You ended up on the hike with this, as we mentioned, just the other permit holder, this guy named Rick. Was this a hike that you wanted to experience on your own? Would that have felt daunting? How did it feel to have someone else there that you could at least communicate with a little bit?
Well, I had mixed feelings. When we do our hikes in the magazine and our books, we say rule number one is to never hike alone, and that is probably one of the very most important things. So I was violating rule number one by planning to go out there alone. That said, it was. I sort of wanted to have that solo experience of, walking back in time, because that's really what you're doing. You start out in 2000, in 15, and end up in, 1250 or something.
As you get even closer to the end of the piece, you said with most awe-inspiring places, there's some harbinger of grandeur. You say at the Grand Canyon, at Walnut Canyon, but at Keats Seal, there's nothing. I wonder if you could delve into more of that. There isn't something that hits you as, this is what I would want to tell someone about. Is that kind of what you're saying?
It is exactly that. You drive up to the Grand Canyon, you go through a ticket booth and other places. And, this was something where I knew it was coming. I'd done my research. I'd seen the photographs. But, you're walking through this long canyon covering all these miles, and you pass a lot of these cliffs that are all very unique, of course, but they're the same in a way. They're these big, towering, spectacular cliffs. And there's a point on this hike where you come around a corner and you come to this group of cottonwood trees, and you kind of look through and you see another cliff out there, and then you do a double take, and all of a sudden, there it is, these spectacular ruins, which are, sheltered by this overhang that has, protected this amazing place for so many years. And it was just all of a sudden there. And there's that Indiana Jones sensation that we all sort of have a sense of when we watch those movies. It's coming upon a place like this. And knowing that, really, you've just stepped back in time and that nothing has really changed, over all those centuries. And it was a very, very powerful experience. And even though I shared it with somebody else, it was as if I were alone, because you just sort of get caught up in your own mind and looking out there and imagining what it must have been like to live there.
Robert Steeve is editor-in-chief of Arizona Highways. We've been talking about his piece in the January 2016 issue of the magazine about Keats Seal. It's part of a series of stories under the umbrella Remains to Be Seen. Robert, thanks as always.
Thank you so much.
It's easier than ever to take a gorgeous photo with nothing more than your phone. And with the aid of social media, you can share it with the world for free. But some millennial photographers in the Valley are turning back to classic photography methods on film. KJZZ's Sarah Ventry is here to talk about it. Hi, Sarah.
Hi, Mark.
So tell me about this trend.
Well, it turns out that a number of millennials in and around Phoenix have been taking photos on film. And in some cases, they're actually sharing them with each other on Instagram, which is a social media platform mostly for photographs. I talked about this with Daniel Kim, a professional photographer who shoots in both film and digital, but really has an affinity for film. And also Evie Carpenter, a journalist with the Phoenix New Times, who wrote an article on this community.
I was looking through Instagram and started seeing that people were posting the cameras that they were using. There were these old vintage cameras and the film that they were using. And I started looking into that and found this group of 20-somethings, really young people, who are going back to using those cameras and this kind of old-fashioned photographic techniques instead of just using the app or using digital cameras, because they wanted the look that Instagram provides with its filters, but they wanted to do it themselves. They wanted to do it in the camera.
Were you surprised to find folks sharing these sort of analog photographs on Instagram, which is kind of one of the ultimate millennial forms of sharing?
Yeah, it's a little counterintuitive, but it's also, how else are they going to share it besides just going to meetups and printing out the photos, which, they're doing that as well.
So, Daniel, I want to ask you about this because you are a photographer who uses analog photography. I'm curious, what drew you to that particular medium?
So what draws me to the aesthetic of the analog photography is the color. For me, commercially, what I do is wedding photography. And what film is able to do is produce these colors that are just amazing. They have a lot of soul in them. For me, it's all about the color. Like the character of it.
What's different about the color in an analog photograph versus, say, an iPhone photograph? Or even Instagram also makes a lot of filters that you can apply to photographs to sort of give them a different feel or a different texture. What's different about actually taking and developing the analog film versus having maybe a really high quality digital photograph?
It would be the dynamic range. So dynamic range is the range of colors and tones from darkest to lightest. So there's different shades of black, right? Or different shades of red. For digital, maybe there will be like, let's just say 10 shades of red, from like dark red to a little bit lighter, and so on and so forth. Film has a much larger spread. So you're seeing red, but you're seeing a lot of different red within that red. The other thing is the light parts of the photo. Sometimes you'll see photos and it looks like the sky has just disappeared into nothing, and the blacks are super black. So if someone was wearing a black dress against a white background, you might not see the crinkles of the paper in the back on the white, or the details in the dress, because it's so dark. With film, it's able to bring up the shadows, which means you could see all the folds and wrinkles in the black dress, and also the white background won't be just completely gone. So you'll still see a little bit, maybe like a little bit of gray, you know? So that's kind of, it just produces like a perfect, complete photograph.
Evie, you kind of suggested in your article that this emerging community of younger people, of mostly millennials, who are kind of rediscovering analog photography and feeling connected to it, is perhaps emerging or starting here in Phoenix. It always occurs to me that art trends often begin on the coasts. So does it seem unlikely to you that Phoenix would be the place for this, or do you see it catching on in other places?
It's definitely catching on in other places. I think it's nationally, even internationally, it's kind of coming back. It's similar to in music, people are going back to vinyl. It's a more soulful, as Daniel said, experience. So I've seen it starting here in Phoenix, but it's also happening definitely in the bigger cities.
So for people that don't know a lot about art or don't know a lot about photography, for just an average person who maybe wants family photographs or wedding photographs, do you see people gravitating toward that analog style as well? Or like, does it not make a difference to the average person?
I think the average person looks at the end result, but they would have to be very picky about the end result. A lot of people don't know what they want until they see it. And so for me, when I have clients come to me, some of them don't know that I even shoot film. They just know that they like it. I think photographs are incredibly important, and especially printing your photographs. And this analog process kind of encourages to have physical things, because you never know when a hard drive is going to fail. You never know when your card is actually going to be erased. And it's good to just have things that you can hand around the table instead of bringing everything up on an iPhone and everybody's crowded around. I think that's a more soulful experience, and that's kind of the end result for me, the tangible experience at the end.
That's photographer Daniel Kim and New Times journalist Evie Carpenter.
And that's KJZZ's Sarah Ventry. Sarah, thanks.
Thank you.
Good afternoon. Happy Tuesday. It's the show on KJZZ. I'm Mark Brody in Phoenix. In Valley traffic, I-70 northbound, a crash at Peoria Avenue has the right lane blocked there. Also on the 101 northbound in the East Valley, a disabled vehicle blocks the right lane at McDonald. Sunny skies, 53 degrees at KJZZ at 252.
KJZZ is supported by Stinson Leonard Street. With nearly 500 attorneys providing transactional and litigation legal services from 14 offices across the country, online at stinsonleonard.com.
One way for businesses to go green is to purchase carbon offsets. That means a business gives money to a project that reduces carbon to make up for its own carbon output. But what happens when an individual wants to offset his or her own carbon emissions? The show's Annika Klein found out.
If I've got somewhere to go, I might hop in my car, turn on the radio,
from KJZZ News,
and head out,
Phoenix,
as the carbon dioxide from my car heads up into the atmosphere. The idea behind carbon offsets is that it's possible to make that CO2 disappear with a donation. Linda Kelly with CarbonFund.org explains.
That's the impact. That's the effect that you're
donation has created by supporting that project that is removing carbon dioxide from the atmosphere or creating an energy source that doesn't produce that carbon dioxide in the first place.
CarbonFund.org is one of the many nonprofits that takes individual donations to offset CO2 emissions. Kelly walks me through the process. We start with where my carbon is coming from.
Home energy usage, any vehicle emissions, and then any vacation-type travel will be the primary things.
On the website, I can calculate my CO2 emissions from all those sources, or I can pick and choose. For example, I can just offset my trip to Germany last summer. I plug in Phoenix as my departure city and Frankfurt as my destination, and it comes out to 11,312 miles for a grand total of $20.93 in carbon offsets. Kelly says you can also skip the calculations and just choose the average annual CO2 emissions for an American, which
could be as much as 24 metric tons.
Or about 50,000 pounds of CO2, which translates to $240 a year in offsets, though the price varies by organization.
Then you go to the checkout page where you're able to select the type of project that you want to support.
Reforestation in Brazil, a wind farm in India, and a methane reduction project in New York are some examples of where my $20.93 could go. And then that's it. My flight to Germany is neutralized, right?
It's more complicated than that.
Dr. Harvey Bryan has been interested in carbon offsets since the 90s and says there have always been questions about the effectiveness of some projects that offsets pay for, like planting trees. That's because you can't really measure how effective a tree is the same way you can with a technological solution.
Like if you put solar panels on your house, you can put a meter on that and actually measure that, and that can be documented by your utility. That is a much higher bankable carbon offset than planting a tree in Brazil.
While experts might disagree about the effectiveness of some offsets, Brian hits a point they do seem to agree on. Reducing what you can should come first. As for the leftovers, well, somewhere in the world, there's an offset for that. It's the show. I'm Annika Klein.
The Arizona Cardinals wrap up their regular season this Sunday at home against the Seattle Seahawks, and at the end of that game, the Cards could be the top seed in the NFC with home field advantage until the Super Bowl. Among those paying close attention to that game and the Cardinals postseason is Jess Root. He's managing editor of SB Nation's Cardinals blog called RevengeOfTheBirds.com.
You could kind of see it coming over the last couple of years. They built on the 10 wins in 2013. Last year, the 11. In fact, they were one of the best teams in football before Carson Palmer went down with
their quarterback.
Injury. Yes, and then this year it kind of built on that. It was their quarterback being healthy, Palmer coming back from an injury, and he's playing at a level that we haven't seen really any quarterback play other than maybe Kurt Warner, and he is playing the best football of his career, and there's a belief in the locker room that they can win and they beat anyone. And they're playing really well offensively. And then defensively, they're playing at a high level as well. So it's been kind of in the perfect storm as they've built up talent over the last couple of years. And now they've kept their quarterback healthy. It's been the biggest difference.
You referenced Kurt Warner. He obviously led the Cardinals when they went to the Super Bowl and lost to the Pittsburgh Steelers a few years back. Are there comparisons between those two teams?
Yes, in terms of the success, yes, and the type of quarterback play. But if you look at the overall talent on the team, this is a superior team.
Injuries are always a big part of any NFL team, and the Cardinals recently lost one of their best defensive backs, Tyrann Mathieu. But you mentioned Carson Palmer was hurt last year. They made the playoffs but lost to the Panthers in the first round in large part because Palmer was not there. Have the Cardinals been able to basically stay healthy this year?
They've suffered some key losses, but at positions where they had depth. They signed veteran Chris Johnson, a running back, and people thought he was basically washed up, but he was one of the best running backs, at least production-wise, in football for the first half of the season. He went down with an injury. Andre Ellington, who was a key offensive player for them last year and the year before, he's had some injuries, and it was rookie David Johnson that's kind of taken over and is kind of showing up, showing the football world that he's good. Really, the player that there's probably two players that matter most. One is Carson Palmer, And that goes across the league. And you lose your starting quarterback, you're in a world of hurt. Maybe Patrick Peterson because of what he – his
a defensive
coverage,
back.
Yeah, he plays cornerback. His ability to basically take out one of the receivers of the opposing team, you lose that, and it changes what they're able to do defensively.
The Cardinals blew out the Green Bay Packers this past weekend, much to the chagrin of many green and gold clad fans at the University of Phoenix Stadium. But you know, the Packers are a playoff team. They could win their division depending on what happens next week. From your perspective, where do you rank the Cardinals both in the NFC in their conference and in the entire league?
Well, Vegas right now has them as with the Patriots as the top team. I think they're tied at 3-1 odds right now as Super Bowl contenders. So Vegas sees the Cardinals and the Patriots as the two best bets for the Super Bowl right now. The way the Cardinals are playing in the NFC, there's basically two main. There's the Carolina Panthers. They barely lost their first game just this last weekend. Then you got the Cardinals. The Packers have been up and down. I mean, they're having a great year, but they are without a couple of key players, and they were down three of their starting offensive linemen during the game. So if you look at the Cardinals, definitely you could make the argument are the best team in the NFC. And if you look at the cross of the NFL, really there's no one playing better. Obviously, you've got the playoff experience with the Patriots and Tom Brady. You've got the Denver Broncos with a really, really good defense, although they're playing a backup quarterback in Brock Osweiler from ASU. But, you have to look at the way the Cardinals are playing right now, the consistency with which they played all season, and say they're there. They're among the top teams in the NFL.
Jess Root is managing editor of SB Nation's Arizona Cardinals blog, RevengeOfTheBirds.com. Jess, thank you.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
And I'm joined in studio by Steve Goldstein, co-host of this program, also host of KJZZ's Here and Now. And Steve, tomorrow morning at 11, a special holiday edition of
Mark,
Here and Now.
As you're probably aware based on the calendar, 2015 ends on Thursday.
Really?
So we decided to look back at some of our favorite interviews of 2015, including former President Jimmy Carter, also humorist Lori Notaro, and I know one of your personal favorites, musician Roseanne Cash.
I do enjoy Roseanne Cash and her father, Johnny Cash.
Exactly.
All that tomorrow morning at 11 on KJZZ's Here Now, a special holiday edition of KJZZ's.
That just rolls off the tongue.
It really does. The show was produced by our senior producer, Sarah Ventry and Jimmy Jenkins, with help from Bruce Drummond, Anika Klein, Regina Revazova, and Tiara Vian. Sky Shout and Domenico Nicosia are the digital team. Our managing editor is Tracy Greer, news director Al Macias, our executive producer is John Hoban. We always want to hear from you. Let us know what you think. Let us know if you have some good story ideas, selfies in front of the Christmas tree. We like it all. The show at KJZZ.org. For Steve Goldstein, I'm Mark Brody. This is member-supported KJZZ FM Phoenix and HD. All Things Considered is next. Thanks so much for listening. It's 3 o'clock.